Sixth and the last of our moral issues in medicine, and it was titled Human Experimentation, mostly because there's a chapter in my little book here about that, but I'm going to broaden it out, however, because I think there's another issue that lends itself along with that, and that's the whole issue of certification of drugs and regulation of drugs by our government. I think they go pretty much together, and that's why I'm going to look at them together. If we're going to talk about this issue, I think we have to go back to all the way back to the Nuremberg trials. Most of us who remember the Second World War and the publicity around the Second World War, one of the horrors of the war was the human experimentation which was done by German doctors who had tremendous reputations around the world on human beings. And this was perpetrated, of course, by the German government. And the medical world was horrified and concerned about this ever happening again. And part of the outgrowth of that was a conference held at Helsinki in the early 1960s, when principles for human experimentation were drawn up, and then these were later adopted by the United States, and especially by Senator Kefauver, who really looked at this as a political issue for him to become involved with, and especially with his interest, and he was instrumental in writing a lot of our legislation, which now pertains to our human experimentation and also to the other problem which I mentioned, which was the regulation of drugs in our community as far as their use in medical purposes. Along with, these were originally written in the 60s and didn't really have a whole lot of effect probably until the early 1970s, and I think we need to look at what was going on in the late 60s when these regulations didn't have too much effect, and compare it with what's happening today. In the late 1960s, the United States was, and really still is, the major country or the major force behind the discovery and the development of new treatments and new drugs. Probably in the late 1960s, we were turning out 50 to 60 new drugs per year. For many of these were what we call analogs, which were improvement on already existing drugs, but many of them were also brand new drugs that had been discovered and were really of great benefit to man. We were using these drugs in our society on pretty much a reasonable basis in terms of what the rest of the world was doing. After a drug is developed, it has to go through a lot of experimentation and testing, first on animals, and then being gradually applied to human subjects. Most of the human subjects back during the Second World War and in the early 1950s, a lot of testing was done on service personnel, and this today has pretty much been cut out completely. And then a lot of testing was also done in prisons, and people and the prisoners would agree to take part in experimentation, utilization of a drug. Number one, so that they could live in the prison hospital and get a change of environment and a little better treatment, a little better food, a lot of these things. So it was a direct benefit to them, and a lot of them volunteered for that. This has pretty much changed nowadays. And present time, because of what I would say is excessive regulation, we now are down to a country where we are probably introducing only about 5 drugs per year. And there's only probably one of those that's a really new drug, which has been developed and coming out on the market for physicians' use for treatment of a disease. And all of the experimentation and early development processes of drugs has now shifted to the rest of the world, and especially in Europe, it's a lot of this is going on. And one of the moral questions that I'm raising is, we're developing them in this country. We lead in this technology. Is it right for us then to push these drugs use in other areas of the world, the experimentation process off on other areas, before we bring them back and decide whether they are also usable in our own society? Now, as a physician, I'm affected by these regulations a lot of time also. I want to give you some examples of it in terms of the malpractice area, which our physicians, of course, are always bearing this burden, and we do a lot of treatment and formulate a lot of treatment policy around what is legally feasible or legally the best course for us to go in order to protect our rear, mainly. And I think that this is not always beneficial to the patient. One of the examples that I think of this is the drug lidocaine. It's a pain-relieving drug related to Novocaine, which almost all of you know that your dentist has used on you if you've had it various times. It's been used for many, many years in this country, and it was in the early 1970s that it was discovered when this drug, when given intravenously, had a effect on the heart in that it controlled the irritability of the heart so that abnormal rhythms were controlled for a period of time. And this drug really met a great need at that time, because at that time, one of our problems was when a person had a heart attack, one of the things that happens during the early hours after the heart attack is the heart is extremely irritable. And the heart is very prone to going into abnormal rhythms, and this is the major cause of death. If you look at heart attacks, one-third of them never even get to the hospital after they occur, and it's probably because of this problem right here, the problem of the arrhythmia, the abnormal rhythm of the heart, which makes it so inefficient that it will not pump blood, and then you get brain death as a result of that. And it was discovered by a process which we call serendipity, which goes on quite a lot of the time. A drug or a chemical which was developed for one area is found through serendipity to affect another area in a very positive manner, and therefore has more applications. And so this drug, which had been in use for a long time, was found to be very beneficial in the treatment of heart attack. The problem with that is that the regulations of that day, and the regulations that still are in effect, prohibited physicians from using it for the new indication, even though we knew that it was of great benefit to the patient. And as a physician, I was put in the perplexing position of knowing that I had a drug which would greatly benefit my patients, but knowing that if I used it on my patients, and if the patient should die, and a lawyer or some other person who, for whatever their motivated reasons may be, was angry that person that died, that they could bring me to a court of law, and I would not have one leg to stand on. I would simply have to plead guilty in that, even though I had undertaken that particular treatment with the best medical knowledge of that day. Behind me, that was the most beneficial treatment for that patient. And so doctors were in a situation of a quandary for a number of years thereafter, until the regulation process of the government finally caught up with the technology, finally caught up with this discovery, and allowed physicians to begin using this drug in the treatment of heart attacks. And nowadays, this is one of the first things that we do for the patient for your emergency teams, which are in your cities, that go out to take care of heart attack victims. We have in our particular city, and I'm sure in many of your cities, if you live in a larger city, when an emergency call comes in, they try to identify if it's a cardiac emergency, and they dispatch a special team which goes out to minister to that person and is able to support him totally from a cardiac standpoint. And almost the first thing they do after they arrive is they put a needle in his vein and shoot in lidocaine. And this will calm down the heart and reduce the irritability of the heart for a period of time, during which they can then further minister to him in other ways and get him back to the hospital, where then he can be totally supported. And this has saved a lot of lives in the United States, of a lot of people who would have died and would have never made the hospital, or would have died within, say, the first 24 hours after they arrived at the hospital from a heart attack. So our government, so our regulation in this particular area really, I think, is retarding things. Another area that I wanted to mention was the how politics can bypass these regulations. A very good example is valproic acid, a drug which was developed in this country, was sent to Europe and used extensively over there for probably 7 or 8 years now, and found to be very beneficial in the treatment of childhood epilepsy disorders. And we had the drugs which we are presently using were not nearly as good in comparison for treatment. And people who had children who had these disorders were becoming increasingly aware of the fact that this drug was being used in Europe and was not available in the United States for reasons of regulations. And so they began putting a lot of pressure on their congressmen and on their representatives. And after a lot of hem and hawing, but mainly because of the pressure that was brought to bear on the government, finally this drug was released for general use within the United States. And that's only been about in the last year. And here this drug had been developed in this country, had been used extensively in Europe and this other country for a number of years, and our local regulators were not allowing it to be brought into this country. Of course, a lot of that, you have to look at that in terms of the thalidomide disaster. Thalidomide, I'm not sure where it was developed at.
Germany.
I think it was developed in Germany and was used extensively in Germany and never did come to the United States for general use in this country, and that's why we avoided the disaster, perhaps, of the congenital deformities that it did cause. There are a lot of people who claim that it never could have come to this country. Now, I don't understand always the basis of their arguments. I do know that armed services personnel in Germany did bring, in fact, thalidomide back to this country in very rare instances, and that we did have a few cases of thalidomide babies in this country, but it was not in general use. The other thing I think is that the time frame, one of the reasons why it never came to this country was that the time frame was so short. In other words, it was developed in Germany and put into general use, and it was only used for perhaps a year when they started having these problems with the congenital deformities in children. And so it was discovered so quickly that we avoided it on that basis also. The other example I want to give of government entering into this problem is the swine flu vaccine. And this should be fresh in all of your memories. This became a political disaster as far as I was concerned. The medical profession had very little to do with the whole swine flu disaster. Fortunately for us, I'd say. It was projected by politicians mainly and by public health personnel that there may be a danger of a swine flu epidemic after a few cases breaking out in certain areas of the United States. And it was decided to develop the vaccine, and one of the one or two of the drug companies was pressured into developing the vaccine over there. over some objections, which I'll explain later. And even though the general medical community and the National Institutes of Health did not agree that there was a public health problem as far as the swine flu was concerned, it was released for general use because of political concerns. And if you remember, most of you probably did not get the swine flu from your position, because the medical community in general, and certainly where I came from and where Jim in Seattle came from, it was totally hands off. We did not believe that it was needed, and were concerned that we were rushing into something that we didn't know the full implications of, which later became true. And perhaps most of you understand that a certain number of people who received the vaccine developed what we call an ascending paralysis called Guillain-Barré's disease, which basically starts as a paralysis from the toes and goes all the way up to the top, and then in a lot of people it retards, but in some people it doesn't. And presently right now the federal government is in court with many thousands of suits against it, hundreds of millions of dollars involved in terms of these suits for people who took the swine flu at the recommendation of the government and public health circles, and then had these disastrous side effects when the whole controversy was really a political ploy and did not ever pan out to really be a medical emergency of any sort. Another, as a sideline of that, I want to say that on the matter of the drug companies being pressured into producing the drug. Drug companies right now in the United States, and especially where we're talking about vaccines, really want to stay out of that area if at all possible because of the legal implications of it. Our medical legal situation has complicated the matter of production of drugs and of vaccines tremendously at this particular point. And there is no way that any drug company could have ever withstood what happened in the swine flu deal. I mean, they would be totally wiped out at this particular point. And if you remember back then, President Ford and Congress was saying, we need this vaccine, and no drug company would produce it unless the government would guarantee them that they would not be held liable for any of the side effects of the medication. And if you remember, there was a jockeying back and forth that went on for several months, and finally Congress passed a law which allowed these companies to be relieved of the responsibility, of the medical legal responsibility for whatever side effects may come from the drug. And the companies had already produced the drug under government pressure but refused to release it to the government until they had such a law in hand. And I think they showed a tremendous amount of foresight in doing that, because we all see what happens thereafter. Now it's the federal government, and I really think that the problem really comes back to the federal government that is presently is involved in the courts in trying to deal with the side effects that came from this medication. So this is the first part of the moral issues that I wanted to talk about. Now let's turn to the actual human experimentation area. As I said, prior to the early 1970s, we really did not have a lot of legislation that specifically defined human experimentation, and it was handled pretty much on a moral basis by the companies. And I think they did a fairly reasonable job. The principles that came out of the Helsinki conference basically defined the type of research, what it should consist of, how a person should give informed consent to take part as an experimental subject within that experiment, and how the total experiment should be professionally supervised. one of the first considerations was this research truly needed? What would it be, would the purposes or the end result of this research really benefit all of mankind? Which is certainly of concern. And especially when you consider what I'm going to show you, some examples that have happened since that time. Was the experiment designed carefully and competently so that there would be a minimalization of risk to individuals who took part in the experimentation? Were the people who were conducting the medical experiment people of integrity, intelligence, and compassion? Pertaining to the people who were being experimented on, was the consent of these individuals given freely? Had they been fully informed about the purposes of the experiment, the procedures that would be used in the experiment, what the possible potential risk would be to them as participants in this experimentation? The whole question later comes up then, to what extent is free consent really able to be given by a person who will directly benefit from that experimentation? And this is where the issue of prisoners being involved in it, the prisoner is going to get some definite benefit from taking part in the experiment, in that he'll be living in the prison hospital for a period of time rather than having to live in the cell block, and will be getting perhaps better food, be getting many more personal attention than he'll be getting the other place. The questions are asked, under what conditions should a minor ever be able to take part in an experiment? Should parents be able to give permission that their children could be experimented on when the children have really no ability to really understand the full implications of what they might be taking part in? On the matter of professional supervision and public review, what kind of supervision could possibly be provided by professional people who were not immediately involved within the research? What criteria could be insisted upon to keep the high purpose of the experiment on the track, and make sure that there were not problems developing in other areas? Now I'm going to talk with you about two experiments, mainly that were run by our government, which I think illustrate the problem better. And why this is a controversy now, and why there's a lot of pressure at this particular point to write more regulations and to write more laws, which I think is going to stifle our situation even more. The first one is that it became known not too long ago that the Agency for International Development, along with one of the drug companies, sponsored a Planned Parenthood clinic in the San Antonio, Texas area. And women who were mainly of Mexican-American origin, who already had two children, were given free medical care in this clinic, and part of their medical care was use of the birth control pill. Unbeknownst to them, they were never informed of it, it was decided to conduct an experiment through that clinic to find out if the side effects of the birth control pill were more psychological rather than physiologic. And so under the auspice of this Agency for International Development, a placebo medication was developed which looked exactly like the birth control pill, and was dispensed to a certain number of these Mexican-American women. Well, in a year's time, there were a number of pregnancies by the women, of course, who were receiving the placebo medication. And this really, you have to say that our government fostered an experiment there in which there was no informed consent of the people who were utilizing the clinic. And The next one is even more horrible. The Public Health Service in the early 1930s decided to conduct an experiment on the long-term effects of syphilis. And 400 Negro males in the South who had a diagnosis of syphilis were recruited for treatment in a public health sponsored clinic. The only thing is that the 400 Negro males were never told that they were not going to in fact receive any treatment, but were simply going to be observed over a long period of time to see what the long-term implications and effects of untreated syphilis would be. This came became knowledge, it became known in the middle 1970s, and the experiment was, of course, discontinued at that particular point because of public pressure and what on. But at that time, something like 28 and probably more of these individuals had died from the side effects or from the problems of their syphilis. And so this really was quite a shocking thing to come out about, that under government auspice this kind of research and human experimentation was taking place. Because of this coming out, there is a lot of pressure nowadays in government circles, and specifically in Congress, to begin writing new regulations to more specifically define human experimentation and to regulate it, to see that this does not happen again. So that's where we'll leave it.
John, hasn't the government also sponsored LSD research on people and not notified them that they were receiving LSD just to study their behaviors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has come out also. This was CIA sponsored.
Right.
People were given these drugs without ever being informed without their knowledge. And there was, at least I'm aware of one case which was nationally publicized, of a death of an individual who received it at a party and jumped off of a building.
Are our drug companies then using other countries as a field test there?
Mm-hmm. Presently they are.
This type of activity.
Mm-hmm. They have been forced essentially into that by our regulations in this country at this particular time.
Yeah, when I was in the Air Force, I recall having received at least four different kinds of polio drugs or preventative, and I think I missed the fifth one because I was too old.
They've pretty much done away now with any experimentation on armed services volunteers. Did you volunteer back then, or were you told that you would?
We were supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Volunteer.
Not like me.
I'm interested to know what, as far as the FDA regulations, how much experimentation did they require to document that until they so-called prove that a drug is safe to market? Is there a certain amount of human experimentation that's required before that happens, and how do they go about determining it?
Well, this is a whole area, of course, that's very difficult to define. You know, how much is enough? The rules and regulations are stifling in many ways. I think a good example of them is cyclamates, for instance. We start with the human experimentation, but the human experimentation is done in such a weird way. When you consider that they were injecting cyclamates into a rat's bladder in tremendous dosages and inducing cancer, and thereby saying that it's controversial to say, first of all, that a drug given to an animal will definitely cause cancer in a human being. But then when you, in the form of an experiment, you use the drug in a totally different or in a totally different way than it would ever be used in a human being, and then try to base predictions on that experiment that would apply to humans, that just doesn't follow, you see. When you consider that all of us take cyclamates, what are we going to do with the cyclamates? We're going to eat them, basically. There is going to be effect on those cyclamates by our stomach acids and by the digestive process, which is going to change the particular molecule tremendously. Then to say that you can predict on the basis of injecting cyclamate into the rat bladder, where you have totally different circumstances for absorption and changes on the drug, and you're going to be able to predict what's going to happen to a human on the basis of that, it just doesn't follow.
Bad science.
It is. It's bad science. It really is. I personally think that if you took peanut butter and injected it into a rat's bladder, you could probably cause cancer. And
what's up, dog?
And should we take peanut butter off of the market? You know. The other thing is it's really responsible. They've said that I've read someplace that if maybe you know better than I do, Jim, but if you were to get the same amount of cyclamate into a human that you were injecting into a rat's bladder, you would have to drink something like 800 cases a year of pop containing cyclamate, isn't that right?
Something like 2 cases a day, I remember.
Yeah. And and so there's, you know...
The bad part about the cyclamate controversy is that, and this is why it's still on the market, American Diabetic Association is very much against the taking off the cyclamates because it does more good than harm. And as you said, the experiments were really not conducted on a double-blind study. In other words, they were not done on a really, truly scientific basis. When I was in Colorado, one of the representatives of the American Diabetic Association went through the entire thing. And so it was kind of that's why it's being kicked around as a football right now.
It's become a political matter, and it's going to be decided on a political basis by people who have no knowledge of what science really constitutes and what's good science and what's bad science.
That isn't really what I wanted to know with my question. Say I work for Park Davis Pharmaceutical or whoever, and I come up with a drug that I think cures the common cold, and I want to get that marketed. What does the FDA tell me that I have to do in the way of human experimentation with my drug before I'm allowed to put it on the shelf in the Walgreens agency or whatever?
They have a protocol which defines the whole thing that this drug has to be taken through. A lot of times it's tailored to the drug and how it's going to be used as to what the protocol may consist of. But it's going to consist of, in a certain point, of animal experimentations which is going to require a lot of time and effort. And once you've proceeded through that, then you present that data to the FDA, and then they will probably prescribe then how it will be used in human experimentation if they feel at that particular point that it warrants further study and that there are no contraindications to use in human study.
But there's a lot of clinical, carefully observed human experimentation going on before it ever makes it to the drugstore shelf.
Oh yeah, tremendous amount.
But then after that point, they still continue to experiment and observe for side effects and so forth?
Right. All physicians, if we have an adverse reaction to a medication, in some cases we're required by law to report this to proper authorities, and you'll find a lot of physicians will just automatically report it to the authorities.
There's a lot of drugs that are being used in experimentation now. They have no consent from the people that are using it. And I just finished teaching a program. I work with the paramedics in the St. Paul Fire Department, in which we are using a drug that we don't know the name of it at all. We just have a numeral. And we are sending our teams out on calls, on runs. And they have the choice of using this drug or lidocaine. And they're using it, they have groups and they follow up on these patients. And I look at the program and it seems to be a good one as far as following up on the patient, but the patient really does not know. Now, could that patient turn around and sue the paramedics or the fire department?
I would think by our present laws, as far as informed consent, he probably certainly would have a legal recourse, wouldn't you? Because you're not giving him a choice of whether he wants to be involved in an experiment or not. first of all. It's totally upon what the decision of the paramedic is as to which drug he wants to use at that particular time.
Lidocaine is presently approved?
Yes, it is.
I have a couple of hands over there.
How could you prove that you didn't give him lidocaine?
The record.
Yes, in the record.
Over here, Walt.
The case of the government sponsoring programs that really hornswoggle the public goes at least as far back as Civil War, and by the time of Teddy Roosevelt. In fact, if you read some of the documents of his political platform, you'll see that they were passed in Congress, involuntary sterilization laws. And those who were coming to this country from what we considered undesirable parts of the world, like the Czech people, or the Slavic peoples, were told that when they came into this country to be naturalized as citizens, they had to receive a series of inoculations for what they were not told. But what it amounted to was involuntary sterilization, so that they would not reproduce more of their kind, because we considered them undesirables. But those who came from Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, France, those kinds of folks, were not processed in the same manner.
I wonder how much real truth to that there is, though. I don't know of any vaccine that you can give that can sterilize a person, you know.
Well, I'm not a medical person either, but I'm repeating this on the basis of documentation that an author by the name of Jeremy Rifkin documents in his book, Who Shall Play God? And it has to do with the whole eugenics phenomenon and the artificial creation of life and genetic manipulation and all that sort of thing. He documents in a series of footnotes these kinds of things that happened. Speeches from congressmen and legislators who said that, in a sense, antedating Hitler's Aryan philosophy in terms of the pure race of super people, you know, that would make our way of life the most desirable. And I think that's an interesting
to me the
in light of what you're saying about the drug, mm-hmm. the drug traffic.
To me, the key thing that you said that really struck home to me, though, is. Who is the perpetrator of this experimentation? It's usually the government. And yet, what do we see now is the government calling for regulations, not to regulate the government, but to regulate the other industries that are out of government further so that they can't possibly do these horrible things which the government has done. And in the process of doing that, what I'm saying is that we're stifling our own progress to a great extent.
With a look at justice, how about the bureaucrat that approves this particular program? There's never any judgment made there,
no
punishment.
No, that's right.
But aren't many of those doctors?
Huh?
Aren't many of those doctors?
Yeah.
Bureaucrats?
Sure, sure. That's right.
Plus those who do the inoculation.
There are doctors who are bureaucrats as well as there are secretaries and administrators and whatever. There was somebody over here was raising their hand and didn't get two bits in.
Somebody over there.
My name is Jerry Dobley. I'm an attorney.
With who?
And,
with who?
I'm an attorney with myself.
Oh, attorney.
Our firm doesn't represent insurance companies. We represent primarily working people. And occasionally we do have people that walk in the door that have a complaint that they feel may be the result of medical negligence. And I'd just like to address a couple things just said to put it in context of at least the vocabulary that we're used to working with. We don't use the term medical malpractice anymore. We at least use the term medical negligence. And the theory is that a doctor or a contractor or a lawyer or anyone else that pulls themselves out to perform service is responsible to perform that service up to the level of competency in the community. The particular example that you brought of using the drug, I wouldn't necessarily think that you would be guilty, which is the appropriate term in a court, but I would think that if the use of that particular drug resulted in a known side effect that either cause death or paralysis or some very heinous thing that the person is used with. And an action was brought on the part of the injured person or on the part of their family that evidence could be introduced that it was in violation of a government regulation. But that would merely be evidence. On the other side of the coin, the physician would have the opportunity of bringing in evidence from a series of experts, other physicians, that would say that that practice would be completely legitimate and appropriate to use. Very brief synopsis on that. Now, on the government standing behind the swine flu vaccine, I think the theory is that if you're producing a drug that maybe saves a million people or 2 million people, and as a result of that, maybe 5, 10, 20 people are killed or paralyzed as a result of that drug, should those 10 or 20 people pay their own damages? Should those people be the ones that absorb all of the cost of the side effects of those drugs? So if it be your family or your son that was the one in a million that had the side effect for the drug, should your family be the one that pays that entire cost for the rest of their life? Or should that cost be a cost that goes into the production of the drug and everyone that uses it pays a little bit of it, and so those people are taken care of? And that is the shifting and the distribution of the loss. On the issue of informed consent, that's, first of all, I don't know of a case really that has ever been won merely on the legal issue of, I'm talking about from the plaintiff's standpoint, of informed consent. It usually has to be some obvious and open negligence on the part of the doctor. A case that came through our office was that a fellow was treated for iritis, and he was treated with massive doses of steroids. Pick up the PDR, the physician's best reference, and you look at all the list of horribles that can occur to you from the use of steroids, and it goes on for about 3 pages. One of these was the septic necrosis of the head of the femur. He was one of the few people that got the septic necrosis of the head of the femur. And he has now 2 hip joint replacements because of taking the steroids for the eyes. Well, after work on it, and the doctor, of course, never said, now, these are one of the 500 things that can happen. But it became apparent that he'd either taken the steroids or he'd lost his sight. You don't bother with a case like that. You know, you can't go in front of a jury and say, they didn't tell him that he might have had hip joint replacements, but he saved his son. And so there was no informed consent on it. But yet there was also nothing that I think most attorneys would have proceeded in the court on, because the result was the proper result. There was no overreaching. The doctor was looking out for his patient. On the other hand, if we would have a case presented, such as prisoners or blacks being uninformed guinea pigs on a syphilis or on drugs, I think there's probably a pretty good chance that whoever is administering that is going to get in deep trouble. Just a couple comments on those issues.
I'd like to comment back to you that in the case of the swine flu vaccine, for instance, the 2 companies that were finally induced to produce the vaccine would have been wiped out by the legal hassle that happened afterward, and what's likely to happen from that legal hassle.
It's perfectly appropriate the government pick it up. And I think that's the only way to handle something like that, where you have...
Yeah, but that this is becoming more and more the rule rather than the exception, you see. How... the problem that the drug companies are facing is with the production of a new drug and its release onto the market. How do you project what the legal action of isolated reactions may come back to you, which may come back to you? And you know, and this is the, I think this is the feeling also of doctors are more and more, how can we be held totally responsible for what may happen as part of our good intentions?
Well, first of all, doctors aren't, there's no strict liability that applies to doctors.
No.
Now, you might have a strict liability on a product, and that goes through a list of about 10 things that we don't want to talk about right now. But I think it is a legitimate social issue to talk about, that if there is a need to produce a drug for whom a substantial number of people will benefit, and it is known at the time of production that you're going to have a small minority of people who are going to be severely harmed by the use of that drug. Are the few people that are harmed just the price you pay and you wipe them out and you let those families be destroyed and dissolved? Or is there a system picked up to take care of those families? The only system we have now is the one to bring legal action, because there's no other way.
As Jim, I know what you were going to probably say, and I was going to say too. As a practicing physician, I'm under tremendous pressure now from the Food and Drug Administration to better inform my patients, to get this informed consent that you're talking about. Right now, your pharmacist in most of your states, when he dispenses a drug, may also give you a little slip, especially like with for birth control pills. As physicians, you'd be surprised how that's really affecting our practice. Because people are going home and they're taking this little list of every possible thing that could ever happen to them that's ever been known to have happened to a person that was taking that drug, and they're looking at that thing and getting horrified and saying, I don't want to take that drug. And the thing is, the little slip, we could send you home with a whole book that would say, if you take this drug, one person in 10 million has had an idiosyncratic reaction and had acute asthma attack and died. But it doesn't say that on the thing. It just says that it's been known to cause idiosyncratic reactions with asthma and death, sudden death on that thing. And people are not capable of looking at all of these implications. And so it's really complicating tremendously our practice. Now, I'll let you go, Jim.
What I was going to say is, going back to your swine flu vaccine again, which is the reason we're using, I think you're using that, is that this is a step of the future, possibly, which we may all be facing with national health insurance soon, which is, again, a matter of government intervention telling you what you can and can't do. The thing that frightened, I'd say, majority of the medical community in Seattle off from using this, including the medical society, was every day, for about 5 days, a piece of literature would come across saying you had to do this, you had to display it in your waiting room, the patients would have to read this and sign it, and you would have to be witnessed. I mean, this kind of started to, like if you would buy a, say a Pinto, and they would tell you all the problems that would go wrong with a Pinto, the salesman would say, hey, I'm not going to sell this car, because I'm going to be held responsible, you know.
So it would be nice if they said, if you get rear-ended at 5 miles an hour,
right,
it's going to turn into a torch.
Right.
You know, now, That's the difference between talking about all the minute things, which I don't think is necessary to talk about. Now, legally, I don't think you have to go through the list of all the several hundred horribles. I do think that you have a right, a necessity to talk about the major ones.
Well, you and I think that, but they didn't say that.
Well, that's the federal government, yeah. You know. Well,
it's kind of scary, though.
There's, like when a person goes under anesthetic, you know, you give them up about a 3 or 4 liner and what's going to happen to them or what.
Nowadays, we have them sign a very complicated form which says that you may die and does all kinds of things to them. Fortunately, I've been surprised how people will read that and can understand the implications of the fact that there are people who die as a result of a general anesthetic. But we do run into people who, once they read that document, refuse to sign it and therefore make a conscious decision to decline any further medical treatment.
That's a very difficult thing about talking in any general rule, because I know most of my clients, when they go in, or after they've gone in, and they read it, and if a doctor will talk to them for 5 minutes before something happens, they understand the risk, and they say, that's what I have to do. I think that may have been an advantage over a period of time while it was happening, because although I don't know, you'll know better than I. For a long period of time, the doctors weren't taking that 5 minutes to go over. I had a hernia operation and he woke up blind. You know, that was a little hard for him to understand.
Really?
I wonder, you know, sometimes those fears are fulfillments, aren't they? One fellow went to a dentist, frightened all his life, had to go, died in the chair. But it was sort of a wish fulfillment, or a fear fulfillment.
I think sometimes it could be.
I think the point I was going through wasn't so much that it affected so catastrophically a few people. Because in my family, I understood that same risk of gangrene is with any flu vaccination. And the whole point was, let's not have a flu epidemic during the election year. Because that became an election issue.
Yes, it did.
And
that was the whole purpose of it.
Why, if everybody started vaccinating the swine flu, you know, what did we have a few years ago? The Korean flu or something other?
The Hong Kong flu was a big deal.
And I think the whole issue was that the doctors were not doing it, the government had.
Yeah, it's really complicated by the flu vaccines because of the fact that you can't go through that X number of years of human testing before you release it. A flu vaccine is composed of the viral products that we think are that the National Institutes of Health predicts are going to be the major causes of disease within that next coming year. So it has to be tailored to meet those expectations, and you don't have it. And that's why one of the reasons why it's medically, legally, it's much more up in the air. And why I feel that at this point, the government is going to have to take over that whole area, because there's no way that any private drug company is going to be willing to accept the liability which is going to be attendant to all that. And the thing is that this may lead on into the future, into other drugs that we're using. There'll be more and more drugs which will be have to go through a political process before they're released for the use. And I think that could be disaster, or could certainly be detrimental in many ways.
Well, I am interested in the area of eugenics, and not necessarily because I approve of some of the experimentation that's going on, but when you talk about human experimentation, that whole area opens up some moral dilemmas for me. And when you're talking about drugs and the administration of drugs and the processing of and marketing of drugs, one of the frightening prospects from my understanding is that, for example, the National Academy of Sciences, which in the beginning, back in 1928 or 30 or whenever it was established as a federal agency, was supposed to be set up ostensibly as a public forum, as an organization, an agency that would serve the public good and the public need. And over the years, it's become politicized.
That's right.
Those scientists in the eugenics field, doctors and engineers who are working in that area, who are receiving, you know, millions of dollars from the federal government and need the support of the drug industry in order to, you know, continue their experimentation, we're finding that on the major corporations, IT&T and General Electric and others, we find sitting on those boards making major decisions, people in the federal government, people in the drug industry, is a kind of a vicious circle, so that, you know, one serves the other, and, you know, which is simply to say there is collusion, you know, documented collusion that goes on between the drug companies and the federal government, and whether that's to feather each other's nest, I don't know. The drug industry needs federal bucks to do its job, but those of us who are supposed to be served by this are really not having, if you will, informed consent. In terms of what kinds of drugs, you know, are being marketed, you know, we're the guinea pigs, and I guess that's a moral dilemma for me, in terms of the way I vote,
in terms of the kinds of anxieties that I share with a lot of other people in terms of who can you trust in the medical profession for advice when you're really a layman.
Paul, did you?
Yeah, I think some of the things that I'm concerned about. I have no great love or respect for a lot of the intricacies of government regulation. By the same token, I get very nervous when there is a major disaster, whether it's of a tough nature or a hurricane or whatever, and suddenly the government is expected to come in and kind of be the liability of last resort. Now, hurricanes are one thing, and it's kind of hard to blame the government or drug companies or anybody for them, but with issues like, well, drugs or Ford Motor Company or whatever, I'm reluctant to allow American businesses to be taken off the hook too quickly either. I guess I don't really believe in the basic virtue of a private enterprise any more than I do of the American government. I guess I think that there would be some car companies who could make a car and make it cheaply and not do all the work on it, and it become a dangerous thing, and I think they ought to have to pay for that. And drug companies too.
I agree with that.
Well, I think too, if you expect the government to pick up the tab for whatever, that you're also going to have to expect them to lay down lots and lots of regulations and lots of guidelines, which they really know nothing about because they are not the ones working in it. And so if we want them to pick up the tab, we're going to have to.
I'm not advocating that they pick up the tab. That's
not
my function here.
That that's going to go together.
And oftentimes, historically, I think particularly within American society, government intervention has followed private irresponsibility. I think we can see that even with regard to the, for example, the race issue, the intervention of the federal government into issues of race. Very often, states' rights was trumpeted as a local concern, and yet under the guise of that, went on all kinds of local irresponsibility. As a result, we have developed a major thrust to cover the whole 50 states in order to root out pockets of local irresponsibility. That's unfortunate, but oftentimes the federal government is called upon to be responsible and then has to make a blanket law to cover everything in whatever situation.
I feel that in this case, though, it's more a problem of the government's irresponsibility than it is in, in public or private responsibility. And this is where I think the problem lies in this particular area.
But aren't we the government? I mean,
yeah, that's right.
A long way down the road, but
we said that a lot of times in these sessions. We are the government.
Most of us just don't bother to do anything about being the government. I mean, I haven't written to my congressman ever. Maybe some people have, but I sure haven't. And how is he going to know how I feel if I just sit here driving at Holden Village and talking about it, and then I get down there and forget? So I think that we need to remember that we are who we're complaining about.
On a positive note, I see a lot of benefit from the informed consent grant. And, we used to give the childhood immunizations just routinely. Now, before we give them, at least in public health clinics, people have to read a sheet that's long in science. And like you say, that changes the nature of medical and nursing practices. But people, in general, want to be more informed about their health, I think, than they used to, and they aren't content to just let someone else do it to them anymore. When I started in nursing only, 15, 16 years ago, there was an unwritten rule that nurses could not tell people what their blood pressure was. Only physicians could do that. And maybe there are circumstances, rare circumstances, when that's appropriate. But as a general rule, how ridiculous that was. And the trend away from that to knowing more about your own condition, what's being given to you, and if you're taking something that has some risk connected with it, there are circumstances when you're willing to do that, but you should know. And I think that's good.
In the light of what you just said, of course, the state of Washington, this last legislative session, passed a law now that children must be immunized before attending schools, which is going to be interesting to see what the medical legal implications of that are going to be, because there are certain people who, and certain religions who don't believe in that concept.
And also the people that aren't immunized, giving their kids shots, are often, and this isn't fair, but are often ignorant. The disasters that could happen, and these people are being pushed both ways and they have nowhere to go.
I think there's another trend that's useful, and I think it's healthy, and I know that it threatens a lot of positions, and it threatens a lot of preachers too, and that is that whereas 15 years ago the physician was perhaps the most well-educated person in his community, and even before that, the preacher was the most educated one in his community. Anymore, people, as you say, really want to know what's going on with their bodies and in their minds. Yeah. And doctors have, been called by their patients, I think more frequently. People want to find out some technological knowledge that their doctors can share with them, and the doctor is really no longer this guy up on a pedestal who you just say, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. You want to question those prescriptions, and you want to question the processes, and I think that's a very healthy trend, and
I do too.
I hope it grows.
I think most physicians would support you. It was a big change, and I saw a lot of people being very uncomfortable about it when it was forced upon us, but I see now that most physicians are very comfortable with it. Jimmy, you were going to say something?
I think that the majority of people don't question the drug and want to know all the side effects and all the possibilities, because we've never used penicillin. One in how many deaths do they have in penicillin? It doesn't mean we stop using it, but the majority of patients that I think that have any kind of patient-doctor relationship will accept what you give them with a minimal explanation. In fact, you'd scare half of them to death if you give them all the implications. As we said, it's an art as well as a practice, and some people need more explanation, some people will take whatever you give them, and you say, well, it's up to you, doctors, you know best. Any more than you take your car to the garage and you say, well, now I want to know all about it. The mechanic isn't going to about this. It's take all the time. Now, if you're willing, just take an hour of your time and sit down and want to know all about this drug or what shot you're getting, and you're also willing to pay for that time while those other 40 people are sitting on the waiting room. See, it's a matter of being practical. You have to it's a judgment decision. And I think everyone selects their doctor on a judgment basis. You don't just go to him because he's in the neighborhood. Maybe some people do. You go to him because you like him, you have trust in him, just as you go to your minister.
The other thing,
just that's basically what it comes down to, and I think that's what we all do.
The other concern of the patient, though, is that we feel that we're being forced into practicing what we call cookbook medicine. He mentioned the PDR. Which is called the physician's desk reference. And in the PDR, all the various drugs that are used are listed along with their chemical formulas, their side effects, their indications. And increasingly, physicians are feeling that if they exceed the recommended indications of the PDR, then they are putting themselves their head in the noose at for possible legal action, you see. And this was the whole thing with lidocaine, as an example. Lidocaine in the PDR was purely used for relief of pain as a topical injectable anesthetic. Not one mention of its use in treatment of irritability of the heart. And so in that hiatus period of time there, it was the medical community feeling, and maybe the legal community didn't feel that we should have been that concerned about it, but our feeling was that while we were using that drug, for what we knew it was beneficial, in treating the irritability of the heart, we were at the same time putting our head in the noose for possible legal action. The other thing is the dosage of medication varies tremendously. We all have different ways in which we respond to drugs. And the tendency of that PDR also is to list the average dose usage. And this makes the physician feel very uncomfortable when he is either above or below the average dose listed that they list in there. And we would feel more comfortable if we had the ability, or and the legal community will allow us to do it, to exceed or retract from what may be the average utilization recommendations as published in the PDR.
Doctor, on that point, I was thinking about it, I was reviewing some medical records because of some complaint. And I think if I was looking at doctor's notes and he put in that he knowingly used an X amount more than the PDR because then I think that the doctors feel pretty secure in that. I think what sometimes the difficulty is that it seems as if there may not have been a thought process involved in knowingly exceeding a particular amount. If I was going to, you know, do some defensive legal work and say, put down the recommended dosage and you're used few times because, and that's pretty tough to break through later on, I would think.
But like most physicians, the real meat and the real honey of our practice is the time that we spend with our patients and dealing with them to a one-on-one basis. And the thing that we hate worst of all is that terrible paperwork. And we're being forced more and more to put down in our medical records explanations of why we did this and why we did that and what else was considered. And, you know, this can become tremendously voluminous. And we're faced with this most often in the hospital. When I, you know, when I talk, for instance, when I put in a chart that that I feel the prognosis is poor in a patient and that they have declined to have what we call a code 55, or if their heart stops or they stop breathing, we're not forced to go through trying to resuscitate them. I have to write a big note in there and say who I talked to, what relatives were present, and that I had explained completely to them, and as my reason for writing in that chart, no code 55. And I'm not sure where we've made a lot of progress by forcing physicians to go through that exercise all the time to justify their treatments. I think it's added voluminously to our records, and you ought to see the records on patients as they're expanding out and out and out because of this kind of material being added to them, mainly for medical legal purposes and not because it necessarily benefits the patient.
That's not only the case of the doctor, but it's also the case of the nurse. It's gotten to the point where you wonder, how much time do you actually have for the patient?
Yeah.
You're doing all this charting and all this documentation, quote, it gets to be kind of frightening sometimes.
Okay.
Well, the story goes, if I remember correctly, that in the process of rebuilding the cathedral over many, many years, a sign was outside informing all those who wished to enter here at this place is dangerous to your health. Think about that.
And I would like to speak as one who appreciates the fact that nurses and doctors have to do a lot of writing. Now, from your standpoint, I think it is a tremendous inconvenience, but frankly, I'm very glad that those reports and those observations and that kind of detail in the function form is, I'm sorry that you have to do it, but I think it has some effects on the guarantee that I'll probably get a little better medical.
I think it does have some
part. Chuck, you're the one who's paying for that, though, because we have to pay for another person.
Well,
who's
I don't think
do
cost is necessarily so much of the issue.
Yes, it is.
Safety.
Yeah, it is. Cost is a huge issue.
Just well, then the opposite of that is no cost and no care. I mean, just a sort of a trust.
No, there's a middle ground. I think, you know.
Well, that could well be. You know, there may be excessive kind of reporting that's demanded, and nobody reads the reports anyway. I hope somebody reviews and, you know, takes observations from those reports. That's another cost.
But I mean, if you have to hire another person to spend that much more time.
How do you feel about allowing pharmacists to prescribe the medication rather than, you know, there's a pilot project down in California? Because, based on the assumption that they've studied the drugs more than you have.
They've studied the pharmacology of medication. They haven't necessarily studied the use of those medications. So I feel very uncomfortable with pharmacists prescribing for my patients what drugs will be used. Now, but I think what you're talking about is another issue, and this is the issue of pharmacists substituting drugs for what doctors have written. And this is, I think, where the real thing lies. And this is, we're talking about the government and a lot of people are talking about generic medication. Medication which is chemically the same as a brand name but may be produced by another company at a much cheaper cost. If the way now drugs are developed is they go through a certain period of time of development, if they pan out and are released, then the company that developed them and released them on the market has a patent on them for, what is it, about 7 years, I think? And no other company can produce that drug. And so when, if they're the only company to produce it, then they're allowed to set the price on it to recover their cost from developing it. Once that 7 year period of time has run out, then the other manufacturers of drug can begin producing that drug, and that usually drives the cost of that drug down because the forces of competition come in. And this is one reason why, for instance, penicillin, which is such a tremendous drug, is so cheap. And other drugs which are brand new are tremendously expensive. Now that's good. The problem is that there are companies, and this is mainly in foreign countries, who are shipping the drugs into this country, where their standards of laboratory and excellence and manufacture and testing of drug are not nearly what they are in this country. And so sometimes the drug which you buy or which is dispensed by the pharmacist under a genetic or under a generic formulation may technically be the same drug, but it has in no way the same effects as the original developed drug, because there are a lot of difference in drugs in terms of how they're formulated, what the particle size is, what actual moiety they're combined with, how the pill itself is made. There are a lot of these pills that they're made in such a way that they're never even dissolved. They go all the way on through in the stool. And what benefit have you had? Sure, it was the same chemical formulation, but if it never dissolved and was never absorbed by the body to work, how did it work? And so this is where the physician is uncomfortable with that. Now, you'll find that most physicians, and I am, and I'm sure Jim is, we're prescribing generically now where we know that there are generic equivalents available that are, in fact, cheaper, and trying to pass that cost on to the patient. There was a lot of publicity lately about the government now ordering all the pharmacies in the country to withdraw the drug Lasix, or the generic equivalent of Lasix, off of their market. The politicians, you know, had decreed we've got to push these generics. It's going to drive the cost of medicines down. It's going to be beneficial to everybody. And they discovered after this generic equivalent of Lasix was released on the market, I can't remember what it was.
Furosemide. I don't know.
There was what was the problem with it, though, the generic equivalent that was produced? I don't know whether it had a bad side effect or it wasn't working at all or what it was. It wasn't working. But anyway, yeah, here it was. The government pushed its release on the market, then after it had been out about 6 months, they ordered it taken back up again because it didn't work at all like the original drug that had been produced. And this happens quite frequently. So there's, you know, there's benefits of generic prescribing, and there are problems with it also. And this is an area where we need to regulate it. One of the best things I've ever read about this that's really funny is that the Army, a number of years ago, bought a drug from an Italian firm, and it came in the form of little vials with a very clear liquid in it, and they bought boxes and boxes and boxes of this drug, And it was only after they'd had it for a period of time and started testing it and realized that it wasn't working that they started testing it, and they found out that they had bought from this company in Italy vials of plain water. There was no drug in it at all. And they had bought, you know, gross of this kind of thing. Have a good lunch.